picture would disappear. It becomes pixelated. Very similar to over-the-air broadcast digital television. The way those converters work is that when they lose the signal, they freeze the picture for a certain length of time before it finally gives up and gives you a message across the screen, weak signal. Let me drop. Believe it or not, the branch coming in front of the dish, lowering the gain of the dish, interrupting the signal, good common sense. That's one method of failure of reception. The rain cloud is an entirely different method. They look like they have similarity. Let me discuss the rain cloud first. The way the frequency reuse takes place, frequency number, channel number one and channel number three of the RF carriers on the satellite are directly adjacent to each other, roughly 70 megacycles wide. Let me round off the frequencies. Let me assume that channel number one went from 11 gigs to 11.07, 70 megs higher. And channel number three went from 11070 to 11140, 11.1140 megahertz, if I got that right. You know what I mean, 70 megs and 70, yeah, I think it's right. That's the odd number channels. The even number channels bridge the gap. 35 megs above the low end of the band and 35 megs below channel number three is the frequency region for channel number two. So the odd and even channels, they separate them by polarization. I think all the odds are clockwise and all the evens are counterclockwise. As long as your dish is properly tuned so that it has approximately 30 decibels of separation between a clockwise signal, which is probe number one on your feed horn of your dish, and counterclockwise, which is probe number two, and the electronics flips from one to the other, the two entirely separate low noise amplifiers in your block down converter of your satellite receiver. And so those two probes, properly tuned, one's looking for a clockwise signal, one's looking for a counterclockwise signal, they're looking at the same satellite simultaneously, and depending on whether or not Alan has selected an odd or an even channel, the smarts in the electronics knows which one to listen to. It'll look, listen for the clockwise or the
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
It first decides that, hey, Alan has just selected an odd or an even. It'll select a clockwise or a counterclockwise, and then it selects the right frequency to listen to in order to get that signal. When raindrops come along, and when the rain is heavy enough, the raindrops are not round objects. They eventually become tear-shaped drops. The tear-shaped drops take that beautiful clockwise signal, which should propagate through the rain cloud with very little insertion loss, probably a small fraction of 1 dB. The attenuation of the cloud is not the problem. The problem is that the non-round teardrops start creating a cross-coupling in space between the clockwise signal coming out of the satellite and the counterclockwise signal, so that when you're on the far side of that cloud with those great big raindrops, you now no longer have 30 decibels of separation. You might have 15 dB of separation between clockwise and counterclockwise. Therefore, probe number one that's looking for a clockwise signal is seeing a mixture of clockwise and counterclockwise. Those two signals are mixed on top of each other, interfering with each other, and the converter says, I give up. Forget it, Alan. I'm just going to freeze the signal and give you a blotchy-looking signal for the little bit I get through periodically. So it is the cross-coupling created by the larger raindrops that creates the problem when it comes to a rain cloud. Now, if you use a larger diameter dish, which gives you a larger signal-to-noise ratio, it will make some improvement for two reasons. Let me drop. Number one, you will be getting a larger signal, better carrier-to-noise ratio, which gives the detector a little bit more tolerance of the undesired signal. Second of all, the higher gain dish, by definition, has a more narrow horizontal beamwidth and a more narrow vertical beamwidth. Therefore, it is looking at a much, much smaller volume of rain cloud. You can see what's going on here. Because if your dish happened to be 3 degrees wide, which is approximately what it is with a normal 18-inch dish, I think it's about 4.5 degrees wide, you're looking at a lot of cloud simultaneously, and you're getting all of those echo signals of all of those raindrops in all of that great big cloud volume. You go to a dish that is twice the diameter, for instance, a 36-inch dish, which, by the way, a number of people in the United States will buy a 36-inch dish because they're listening to a European satellite that's on the horizon where the footprint of the satellite is not favoring that particular direction. They're getting too weak a signal. By using a bigger dish, they get a stronger signal, and they can watch the European television as if they were stationed in Europe. You buy one of those 36-inch diameter dishes, it will have half the horizontal beamwidth, half the vertical beamwidth, one quarter of the cloud volume, which will drastically increase the probability of you getting a stronger signal with less cross-polarization because you're looking at less cloud, and only those little bitty dense sections of the cloud that have the great big raindrops are still going to give you grief. Let me drop one more little piece of 10-minute information here. Now, when the branch of a tree comes in front of your satellite dish and the signal disappears, common sense would lead you to believe the attenuation of the signal flowing through the branch of the tree with its leaves is the reason that you get dropout. Good guess, primarily no. The insertion loss of the branch of the tree is a small fraction of a dB. That would not kill the signal. That low noise block down converter is a beautiful piece of cryogenic electronics. Yes, it's all operating physically at room temperature. Electronically, it is running at something like 30 degrees Kelvin, 30 degrees above absolute zero, which is roughly 260 degrees below room temperature centigrade-wise. It's a very cold piece of electronics. That tree, with its leaves sitting at 300 degrees Kelvin, if it was an optical system, those leaves are blazing red hot, if you know what I mean, radiating all kinds of random noise signal, black body radiation, into your low noise front end. So the heat of the leaves, because they are at room temperature and partially absorptive, is creating a huge difference in the noise figure of the receiver. Therefore, the carrier to noise ratio going into your converter goes down. So it is the heat of the noise of the leaves of the tree that, in the second example, creates a dropout of signal. Now you know why a satellite system must look at clear blue sky and nothing else in between if you want good reception. So go for the big dish. It'll be a great experiment, and I know you're going to get a huge improvement, but not perfect. I still think a couple of percent of the time of what you used to get dropout, you will get a dropout, but it's going to be very rare. Only when that really intense portion of a rain cloud falls into the narrow beamwidth of your new, bigger dish. KC2 RFN. I wonder if some of this is surprising to you. K2RIW in the TechNet. Alan first. Go ahead, Alan.
KC2 RFN. I had absolutely no idea any of that phenomenon was taking place. I just thought very simplistically that it was a matter of opacity, so something was blocking the signal. Now you're telling me that we have trees that are radiating, and don't say that, because the town of Bayville and now Hempstead will start to outlaw trees because they're radiating. And then you're telling me that raindrops are flipping or affecting the polarization, causing two adjacent channels to collide. I had absolutely no idea of that, Dick, and I doubt 99% of the people listening today had known that either. That's quite fascinating. And with the raindrop explanation, I wonder if I went back and built a small, I don't know if you remember the polarators that used to be used on the C-band satellites. I used to install those in the 80s. If that were applied to a DirecTV type dish, would I be able to counteract some of the raindrop effect? Over to you, Dick.
A good common sense question, and the answer is almost no. Back in the days of C-band reception with TVRO, television receive-only terminals, which I've used one of those for 20 years, I've got one of the highest ones on Long Island. My C-band dish for satellite reception, the great big satellite dish, is mounted 60 feet in the air on my tower to clear the local trees. And C-band information is linear polarized. The odd channels are horizontal and the even channels are vertically polarized on satellite number one, so to speak. And satellite number two, very close in orbit, uses the opposite polarity to try to reuse the frequency. So they were linear. And when you operated that polar rotator, you were moving a small servo motor, which moved the probe inside of the feed horn. It moved at 90 degrees to go from horizontal to vertical. And so you would operate that probe so that you would get the most amount of cross-polarization, a cleanest signal, so to speak. In the case of Ku-band satellites at roughly 11 or 12 gigahertz, they are using pure circular polarization. So simply moving the probe would not go from horizontal to vertical, or would not go from clockwise to counterclockwise. Would you be able to, with a network, be able to adjust the polarimetry in the feed horn to compensate for the polarization cross-coupling created by the raindrops? The answer is a partial yes, but there's a catch here. Those raindrops are a volumetric transmission media. You're going through, let me pick a number, a solid mile of raindrops. Some of those raindrops are giving you cross-polarization of one magnitude, and another portion of the cloud, deeper down, closer to the Earth, is giving you a different polarization, cross-coupling magnitude, with a different time delay. So would you be able to, by simply...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
KVAC Golf Zulu.
Golf Zulu, I'm going to go to you in a second, Bill. QBZ, I'll eventually get it right. Would you be able to readjust for the cross-polarization and get partial cancellation with the variation in time delay? Yes, it is possible, but it's difficult. Bill operated a electronic news gathering truck for a number of years, which used both the Ku-band satellites and I think occasionally the C-band satellites. My guess is you've seen some of this cross-polarization characteristics due to rain clouds. I'll bet you've suffered some of the disadvantage from time to time. And was there any simple compensation that Alan could deploy? Bill, you've been there. WB2QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, just wanted to bring up, number one, that I was orthogonal or linear polarized, not circular, what I was doing in the truck I had. And I was never able to achieve any significant advantage with simply horizontal and vertical, trying to make an adjustment of polarity when I got rained out on my receive. Now, I have also been rained out on transmit only, where it was raining for me and not raining at the big old downlink looking at me. And I'd have to sometimes, I was definitely power limited with this truck. A lot of times I would come up, be instructed to hang around 150 watts or so. Once it started raining, I could double my power, get up to about 300, 350, maybe 400. That's where I ran out of steam. And it wouldn't make much of a difference for me. That's just my, observations in the field. Okay.
Okay. A nice, clean audio, Bill, but it's a little bit on the heavy side. You're banging into the side of the repeater, and a little bit of speech clipping is taking place. So, whatever your audio setting is, it could be a couple of dB lower, and your voice would sound a little bit more pure. Or maybe you've got a speech clipper turned on and a speech processor, and the speech processing is a little bit on the heavy side. So when it comes to the C-band satellites, which you did a lot of work with, I think you're saying very little compensation could take place. In the case of Ku-band, I think it's possible. I know you're going to get some definite benefit out of a bigger dish. It'll take a little bit more careful aiming. Each of these satellites are not perfectly geostationary, Alan. Let me drop.
Hey, Dick, all my observations were on KU, my last transmission.
Okay. Now, when it comes to direct TV reception, I'm reasonably sure that is circular polarized, but the uplinking that you are doing as a backhaul to transmit electronic news gathering information back to your broadcaster studio, I think you're saying that was linear. Give me a repeat on that one, Bill. And you were not running circular. Is that true?
That's correct. The band I was using was just below. It's still KU, but just below where DirecTV lives. Prior to DirecTV, there was an Intelsat KU band or an international KU band and a domestic KU band. The Intelsat band used the channels internationally that or for the most part, seemed to be used by the direct broadcast satellites now. I was all either horizontal or vertical, linear polarization.
You've either readjusted your audio amplitude or compression level or backed off on the mic, and you sound a lot better on those transmissions, Bill. So you were using linear, but DirecTV is circular. I'm rather positive you're going to get benefit out of the bigger dish. But there's a catch, Alan, and that is, if you made a very careful measurement of the position of every one of those geosynchronous satellites throughout the 24-hour day, in theory, the Earth rotates once per 24 hours, with reference to the inertial stars in space, it's really 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4 seconds. That's the so-called sidereal rate versus the diurnal rate. Minor difference. But what I'm getting at is, to the casual observer, the Earth turns once per 24 hours, the satellite turns once per 24 hours, they should be perfectly geostationary. There's a catch. No satellite has absolutely perfect addressing. If they drift without their 1 mile cube that they're supposed to be within, they pay a fine to Intelsat, so they have to use station keeping to keep their address. But the degree of accuracy of that address from one satellite to the next is slightly different. To a careful observer, and here's a whole experiment that a college student could do, careful tracking of satellites throughout the 24-hour day, you will find out every single geosynchronous satellite goes through a figure eight pattern every single day, a vertically polarized figure eight, up and down from the equator, so to speak. The only thing left to discuss is, what is the magnitude of that figure eight satellite for satellite number one versus satellite number two? Every one of them is doing it. So when you use a dish of twice the diameter, which means you're going to have half the beam width, there is a slim possibility that that figure eight will walk out of the, let's say, the 1 dB beam width of the dish that you're using.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And maybe a little bit of re-aiming of the dish will take place at midnight versus high noon, if you know what I mean, if you want to get the highest possible signal reception amplitude. So putting a little bit of steering capability, a tiny bit of steering capability into the dish, which could be done by either moving the whole darn dish or just simply moving the feed horn a little bit within the dish. So except for that very slight problem you might run into, you're going to get nothing but benefits, as I see it, by going to the bigger dish, Alan. And it's going to be a beautiful experiment, which would be a great college experiment for a senior project for somebody who's sufficiently interested in geosynchronous satellites. Great question. KC2RFN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
QGZ.
Alan first, and then we'll go over to Bill, and then over to Wesley in that order. Go ahead, Alan.
KC2RFN. Yeah, thank you very much. That was a fascinating explanation. It was not at all what I thought it would be. And I would like to try and construct a larger dish. I happen to have an 8-footer for C-band aluminum that I haven't used for years, and I might use that. So I'll report the findings here. But thank you for that information, Dick. I had no idea about the trees radiating that thermal signature that can confuse the LNB. That makes a lot of sense. And I didn't know it was the raindrops. And Bill, thank you for your input. You telling me that you were getting issues with your transmissions through the rain, which obviously wasn't through rain clouds, really drives the point home that it's the raindrops causing polarization problems. Thank you both. KC2RFN, back to net.
Yeah, part of the problem that Bill was running into is that he's transmitting from point A. Let's say he might be located in Key West, Florida, let's say. He's uplinking through a rain cloud in Florida up to the geosynchronous satellite. The satellite is sending the signal back down to his broadcast center in Manhattan. And so Manhattan is looking through an entirely different chunk of atmosphere than Bill was transmitting through on the uplink versus the downlink you're going to Manhattan, and vice versa. Manhattan might be getting a rain cloud, and Key West, Florida, where he is, maybe not. So there could be apparent non-reciprocities going on here, and one part of the link could be running into different problems compared to the other. The rain clouds, in the case of a very severe rain cloud at C-band, I've seen the situation where with my steerable 8-foot dish on the 60-foot level of my tower, there were times when a rain cloud would come along and the signal on the screen would start getting snowy and fade out. This is an analog FM modulated signal I was watching in those days. if I reposition the dish, the signal would come back in magnitude for the next 20 minutes. And when the rain cloud drifted out of the way, the signal would fade, and I'd have to put the dish back to where it originally was. In other words, the dielectric characteristics of the rain cloud, in my case, because the raindrops were so darn small compared to a C-band signal, way down at 3.8 gigahertz, that there wasn't a cross-polarization effect because the frequencies are so much lower. There, the cloud was a dielectric medium that was doing a new beam forming, bending the beam into some other direction for the apparent direction of arrival to my QTH. So, rain clouds can do all kinds of funny things, as you can see. I bet your Bill's run into some of that. KB2, WB2 QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Bill.
Yeah, one of the other issues I ran into was, once I was outside the actual rectangular, what was usually the CODIS beam for a lot of this KU stuff. You know, if you were down in South Florida, you were 3 or 6 dB off main beam anyway, so it didn't make a lot of sense to waste a lot of energy over the Gulf of Mexico just to cover a little bit of Texas and a little bit of Florida. But the only other thing was, I think right around about a 1.75 meter antenna is where you have to worry about station keeping. As you indicated, the figure eight pattern is primarily from our vantage point here on Earth up and down. You don't see a whole lot during the period of time, the 6 or 8 hours while it's moving left to right, either on the top or the bottom of the cycle. But you do see a decent amount of motion during the period of time that it's moving up and down in that figure eight. And sometimes I might have to do some touch-up in about a 1.75 meter antenna. Anything larger than that, you would normally have to touch up a little bit as the satellite bagged around in its box.
Now, let me make one other recommendation to you, Alan. It's a good experiment to use the 8-foot dish that you've got, but it could be extreme. The normal TVRO, the normal direct satellite TV dish, DirecTV, is an 18-inch diameter offset-fed parabola, and there's a huge advantage of it being offset-fed. That means the feed horn is not located in the middle of the beam, and the reflections off the feed horn and the side lobes that look at hot Earth are a big factor. Whereas that 8-foot dish you've got is a so-called prime-fed dish. The feed horn is right in the center. That's a significant disadvantage for two reasons. Number one, the reflections off the horn create some side lobes that are looking at hot Earth, so that dish will run at a higher lower gain to temperature ratio compared to a dish at that size by simple calculation. Second of all, when the signal is transmitted, if you were transmitting, I'm going to give a transmission example, even though you're doing pure reception, but the laws of reciprocity, the same effect has taken place. Let me drop. If your feed horn was transmitting on a prime-fed dish, the majority of the signal goes out, touches the dish, sees the parabolic surface, angle of incidence equals angle of reflection, the right phase delay takes place, so what comes back out of the dish is a pure, planar wave aimed at your particular satellite. That's the good news. A certain percentage of the energy out of the feed horn hits the apex of the dish, reflects back into the feed horn, changes the standing wave ratio of the feed horn, and changes the noise figure of the feed horn. Therefore, your low noise block converter, which is made for a particular focal length to diameter ratio dish, a very far dish, like a 0.6 F over D, maybe 0.7, whereas your 8-foot dish is most likely a 0.35 F over D. The feed horn is not optimized for that. So you're going to get reflection back into the feed horn, the noise figure is going to be higher, the side lobes are going to be greater, the noise temperature of the system will be lower. If you're a guy who has resources, therefore you have the resources to go out and buy, build, steal, whatever, a 3-foot dish instead of a 18-inch dish that you've got right now. I recommend the 3-foot dish offset-fed variety. Let me drop. When you go to the 8-foot dish, you're running into the problem of the 8-foot dish has nowhere near the surface accuracy. There's all kinds of bumps and grinds in the 8-foot dish, which starts showing up significantly at KU band. Therefore, the beam that comes out of the KU band frequency on an 8-foot dish is not a nice pure cucumber, if you know what I mean, with a couple of rings around it. It's a very ugly looking thing with near inside lobes and a peculiar shape. So, and it's also going to require very precise aiming. So you're way ahead of the game to do the next step of the experiment with a 3-foot dish, not an 8-foot dish. I'm not saying the 8-foot won't work. I'm just saying there's a lot of problems of using it, and I'm not sure you want to go there if you can possibly avoid it. I wonder if some of that makes sense. Let me pass it back to you first, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet. Trying to make life a little easier for you, Alan.
And I appreciate that. It's much easier to work with a 3-footer than an 8-footer, especially when they're solid. But I must admit, Dick, this is all counterintuitive. This is almost the exact opposite of what I would have thought. A bigger dish being at a disadvantage compared to a smaller dish. But that's what the TechNet's all about, and that's why you won the award. So I will get the proper dish and see what happens. I'll put the two side by side on the same part of my roof and see if I can see a signal difference or not. Anything to get around this constant loss of television, because to me, most of the time I'm going to watch television is when it rains. And if there's no television when it rains, what's the point? All right, no, thanks, Dick. I'll do that. I'll start off with a small dish. All right, take care. KC2RFN, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you're going to like that 3-foot offset fed. You definitely want an offset fed dish with the right kind of a low-noise block down converter feed horn that's made for that particular dish, for that particular focal length to diameter ratio. With a good match, you'll get a lot of performance out of one of those 3-footers. And they're primarily sold to the people who want to watch European television while they're located on the east coast of the United States, because they're outside of the footprint. Footprint really means that the satellite out in space has got a high-gain dish where the dish is pointed at approximately the center of the Earth in some cases. So when you're out toward, if for instance, an American domestic satellite was aimed at, let me pick a number, Kansas City, Kansas, for the people who are watching television out on eastern Long Island versus the people who are watching in San Francisco, they are way outside of the main lobe hotspot from that dish that's aimed at Kansas City. You got to aim the dish somewhere, at CONUS, continental United States. So they have a whole lot of plots of how strong is the satellite signal in various portions of the United States. They're great big elliptical circles superimposed on the United States, and the inner circle might be the number 35, the next circle out from Kansas City is 34, and the next one out there that includes New York State is 33. Those are dBW of EIRP. In other words, how many watts per square meter is the signal coming from the satellite into those areas? And that plot of those circles of signal strength versus the map of the United States is called that satellite's footprint. So with the proper web search for the footprint of your particular favorite satellite, you'll find out each one of the individual frequency assignments. In other words, even though you're watching a particular satellite that's got 32 channels to it, each of the 32 channels, for a bunch of complicated reasons, has a slight...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Each of the 32 frequency assignments on that satellite that you're watching, one particular satellite, has a slightly different footprint in magnitude and shape because of the way the dish behaves at doing the transmitting, the exact amount of power each one of those transmitters on board has, and so on. So they all have different footprints, and if you want to go to the next step of understanding of what's going on, you'll be requesting the footprints for the various channels of, or transponders as they're called, of that particular satellite. Ain't it fun? This crazy stuff. Wesley, I know you got a question on some of this. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
QGZ real quick.
Bill after Wesley. Go ahead, Wesley.
I was just asking about stock antennas, stock dishes, and the difference between the commercial big dish that is being used by the cable TV to get the channels from the satellite and make money on it by sending it over the cable. So, what is the difference between the old type of grid-like huge antenna that was used 20 years ago for the satellite the big dishes commercials being directed to the same satellite right now, and a stuck antenna configuration that could be utilized by us. Or I just simply Google if I have to and buy the big commercial dish. I don't care. Back to you.
Back in 1985 approximately, a person doing a television receive-only terminal, TVRO, used approximately a 10-foot diameter dish. There's about three reasons why the ground station for a home satellite reception was 10-foot in diameter. Number one, the satellite was transmitting approximately 5 watts of power into a size of dish on the satellite that they could deploy in those days. The modern-day DirecTV satellite doesn't transmit 5 watts. It transmits 150 watts, and it's not transmitting it at 4 gigahertz, which is what it was doing in 1985. It's transmitting at 11 or 12 gigahertz. So approximately the same size dish, approximately 3 times higher in frequency, which gives you approximately 10 times more gain for the transmitting dish because of the higher frequency and same size of dish. And from 5 watts to 150 watts, they were, 30 times higher in power. So they're 30 times higher in real transmit power, 10 times higher in gain because of the higher frequencies used. The bottom line of all that is you no longer need a 10-foot diameter dish. A 1.5-foot diameter dish does it. They did that because very few people they knew. Let me drop. They knew ahead of time that very few people, when it comes to mass reception, I think there's something like, at one time, 20 or 30 million domestic TVRO, direct TV reception type antennas in the United States. And only a small percentage of those people have the real estate and permission from their landlord and whatever to put up a 10-foot dish. So they knew they had to do something to increase the transmit power and footprint, and so they did that at great expense, and now a much smaller dish gives you adequate reception. And the bigger dish, if you decide to use it, is capable of giving you a higher signal-to-noise ratio, if and only if you're able to precisely aim it, and if you're able to get enough surface accuracy. And those can be fairly difficult requirements. I have never seen, but I'm sure there must exist, a domestically purchasable 10-foot diameter offset fed dish, parabolic dish. It must exist in the commercial world. I've never seen one on a private home. That technology didn't exist in 1985 when that kind of satellite service was taking place. Bill, V2QGZ, K2RIW. Yep.
Forgot to talk about stuck antennas.
Must be those darn raindrops.
I think Bill went to his bedroom with a handy talkie, and he doesn't know that he's not making it.
Yeah, okay, I'll give it one more try.
Yeah, Bill, you're very noisy, and you didn't make it up till now. While we're waiting for Bill to go back to his shack, you could stack a pair of dishes and get 3 decibels more gain compared to 1 dish. That's the good news. The bad news, 2 dishes side by side represent 3 dB more gain at the peak of beam, but a more complicated pattern, which is called an interferometer. If you did a computer plot of the pattern that you get from a pair of dishes that are vertically stacked, you would get a resultant beam that is more than twice as narrow vertically, with the exact same beam width horizontally, and a bunch of other side lobes. If you could see a vertical stacked pair of dishes, the pattern, it would look like a horizontal beaver tail pattern in space. Instead of it being the main lobe being a cucumber, it'll be a horizontal beaver tail, which is not bad, but it takes some extra rigmarole to learn how to use that. And to take a pair of vertically stacked dishes and steer them by way of motors, again, requires a little bit more complicated mechanics. doable, but you're a little bit ahead of the game by using a larger dish. If you used a 30-inch dish, a 36-inch dish, instead of a pair of 18 inches, you'll get a total of 6 dB of improvement with the 36-inch dish, where you're only getting a 3 dB improvement with a pair of 18s, and you're going to get a nice, clean pattern with a lower gain, a higher gain to temperature ratio, a lower noise figure of dish if it's properly set up electronically and mechanically. So I'm not saying you can't do the stacking. I'm just saying I don't recommend it compared to buying one good dish. Let's see if Bill is back online. WB2QGZ, K2RIW.
Yep, I agree with Signal. What I was going to say is, if Alan's interested, I have about a 3/4 meter offset fed KU antenna that he's more than welcome to fool with. It sits on like a 2-inch or a 2.5-inch piece of pipe. It doesn't weigh very much. It's not very big. That's the mount it uses. And he just have to adapt. He just would have to adapt his feed to this particular feed support, which shouldn't be too big a deal. And if he's interested, he can get with me at WB2QGZ or WB2QGZ at ARL.net.
Now, 3/4 meter is 29 inches. 29 inches versus 18 inches. I'm doing a quick calculation right now. And I take 20 log of that. Okay. 4.3 dB. He'll get a 4.3 dB improvement. He'll get a 29 versus 18. He'll get a... I don't believe that. Let's try that again. 29 versus 18 inches. Okay. Divide, 1.6. So his beam width will go from approximately 5 degrees is what he's got right now, and he'll be going down to something like 3 degrees. It's a significant improvement. That's a nice commercial dish, that 3/4 meter dish. I know that inexpensively he can buy a 36-inch dish intended for satellite reception for European satellites for an American citizen. And so your dish is a high-quality dish. The price is right. Alan should take you up on it. But ultimately, I think he's going to get the most of that improvement out of a 36-incher. There he would get a full 6 dB improvement as opposed to a 4.3 dB improvement in signal-to-noise ratio, and also a significant improvement when it comes to the total volume of a rain cloud he looks through. Over to you, Alan, in case you need a fill on how to get a hold of Bill. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you, Bill. I will take you up on that. It's better to have more material to experiment with, and perhaps I can pick your brain as well. I'll contact you at the ARRL.net site, and we'll get together on that. Appreciate it.
This is the last question.
Go ahead, Wesley.
How about around 10 feet or even a large commercial one used by the cable TV, gathering the signal from the satellite and sending it to the clients? How about if I acquire this one? I can get a good price, respectively.
Yeah, when it comes to the ground stations, like, say, for instance, HBO over in Hopog, which uplinks the satellite signal, that after it hits the satellite, gets downloaded, sent downwave, DirecTV to all of the millions of TV watchers in the United States, they're using a very large dish for a bunch of reasons. Number one, they want to make sure they've got extremely high signal-to-noise ratio going into the satellite. They want to make sure that the satellite is not configured in such a way that a weak signal would be operative. Otherwise, all kinds of people would be jamming them. There was one single jamming episode that occurred in roughly 1986. A man who called himself Captain Video, and he decided to jam HBO for about a 20-minute period one night. And boy, that upset all kinds of people. Let me drop. And what the FCC did is to study very carefully the the recorded pictures as to what came back out of the satellite when this man did uplink jamming. And they found out that the particular brand name, I think it was now Kyocera, no, I can't think of the brand name, it was a company in the Hupog, Long Island, in the Melville, Long Island, that made a pattern generator that was used, and they put it all together. They found out where was there a ground station that was unattended at the time, that only one person was present, that had a particular brand name and model number of pattern generator, had the right amount of power output to do that, and it all got boiled down to one particular guy in Florida, and they zeroed in on him and fined him for doing that. So you want to make sure that the satellite only has the capability of a properly equipped ground station. You want to make sure there's a pure signal going through it with high signal-to-noise ratio. You want the ground station doing the uplinking to have a very narrow beam that aims its signal at one particular satellite only, and 1 degree away in longitude, in other words, to the east and the west, there's another satellite, and you want to make sure that your signal is not jamming the other satellites. So they got some very strict rules as to what pattern is allowed to be used on an uplink satellite. By comparison, the 18-inch dish that you're using, the fact that it listens to, it's got a beam width that can hear a couple of satellites at once. As long as those satellites are properly cross-polarized and properly positioned, the fact that your receiver is receiving more than one signal, it can differentiate between them, if you know what I mean. See, you can tolerate some beam width sloppiness on the downlink that you cannot on the uplink. So the commercial dishes that are doing uplinking have got some very stiff requirements by comparison to downlink. And so the world has changed.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The world has changed a lot from the C-band home satellite reception on 3.8 to 4.2 gigahertz that was taking place in roughly 1985 compared to the 11 or 12 gigahertz reception of satellite TV taking place today. Lots has happened since then in the encoding and encryption techniques and frequencies of use and so on. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in tonight. Kent Mill, it's time to go over to your mailbag. After that, I'm going to have a little bit of a session on the craziness from my point of view that's going on in Hempstead because of what they did on Tuesday. They passed a bunch of rules. They voted on a set of zoning laws that are going to create an awful lot of grief in Hempstead, and I think it's a lot of smoke and fury that's not going to signify anything beneficial from my point of view. We'll discuss that. So go over to your mailbag, Mel, and what's the major subject you've been getting questions on this week? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, yeah, it's getting kind of late, so I'll jam in, see if we can jam one in here. I'm just really looking at one. Okay, last week, in a couple of weeks, we discussed questions they had, people, young people, on putting up dipoles, type of wire, methods of hanging it up, things like that. Now it's come down to a fact that how do you select a balun, or balun, or balun, B-A-L-U-N. They got so many on the market, 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 4-to-1, etc. How do you know which one is the desirable one for the dipole? Want to go into that, Dick? Over.
Yeah, when it comes to putting a balun on a dipole, from my point of view, it's putting icing on the cake. In other words, the dipole will work beautifully well without the balun. You get a little bit better performance with one. But if you don't have one, it is not a showstopper. 8283. Do I have the right pages? Yes, I do. Because most dipoles have approximately a 70 ohm impedance, because most of us use 50 ohm transmission line, 50 versus 70 ohms is a very small error. It's about a 1.2 standing wave ratio. As such, if you buy a 1-to-1 balun, in my opinion, it's going to do the job 90% of the time. You don't need other ratios. Now, if your particular dipole is a folded dipole instead of a normal center-fed dipole, or if you're doing something more exotic by feeding the dipole at the outer end instead of the center, and you're doing it with some kind of a balancing device, yes, there you want a different ratio. But from my point of view, a one-to-one balun on a center-fed dipole does the job, and the main reason, let me drop. The main reason you use that one-to-one balun is because mechanically it supplies everything you need at the center of the dipole. It's got a nice hanging hook. It's got a weatherproof procedure, a weatherproof enclosure. It's got a nice connector at the bottom that takes the UHF PL-259, SO-239 out of your coax cable and connects it properly. It's got the two eyes on the side that you can wrap the wire through and solder it down to some lugs. So for mechanical reasons is the main reason you use the balun. The secondary benefit you get out of it is that it is doing a baluning function, B-A-L-U-U-N or B-A-L-U-N. It is a contraction of two words, balanced to unbalanced. Your coaxial cable is an unbalanced structure. By that I mean when the coax cable is being used correctly, essentially all of your signal is flowing down the center conductor, and that signal is contained between the center conductor and the inner surface of the outer shield of the coax cable. All that signal is supposed to be contained within center conductor and dielectric material of the cable, and nothing is supposed to exist on the outside. The cable is supposed to be perfectly shielded. Let me drop. That is a description of the normal use of RG8, say for instance, coaxial cable. Thoroughly shielded, unbalanced structure. You take the two output connectors, so to speak, on the end of that cable, center conductor and shield, and connect them directly to a dipole, which is the quick and dirty way of doing it, and it works. Because of the way the dipole itself acts, you would think at first that, gee, all the signal is on the center conductor. If I connect that to the left-hand side of the dipole, I'm putting all the signal on the left-hand side and putting nothing on the right-hand side. You could easily think that. Well, the dipole is sort of like a seesaw. He is going to force a balancing condition. No matter how you feed it, he's going to move you in the direction of half the signal on the left-hand side of the dipole and half the signal on the right-hand side. The bottom line is the dipole itself, by the way it acts, will force some signal to flow back down the shield on the outside of your coax cable. Once you connect this beautiful shielded structure called coax cable directly to a dipole, you have now forced your coax cable to be an unshielded structure with RF energy flowing down the outside of it. That's not necessarily bad, but in certain circumstances, if that coax cable runs alongside of your adjacent apartment building, your adjacent neighbor in your particular apartment building, and his television set is against that wall, the signal that's on the outside of your coax cable, which used to be a shielded structure and no longer is, could give his television set or his hi-fi system grief, or his intercom system or his telephone system grief. Whereas when you put a balun on the end of the coax cable, the balun accepts the unbalanced signal coming from the coax cable, forces it into a balanced signal with equal amount of plus and minus on
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
The balun itself electronically forces equal amount of signal out of phase, 180 degrees out of phase, on the left side versus the right-hand side of the output two rings on the balancing structure, which go to the two halves of your dipole. So it does, let's call it the isolation of the shield. And how it does that magnetically, what's going on inside, the transformer that does all that, that's another whole discussion. So your primary reason for using a balun is mechanical, and very closely behind that is the electronic performance improvement. So a direct connection of coax cable to a dipole works like a charm. One-third of all the guys out there using dipoles are doing it that way. It's not ideal, but it works. It's not a showstopper. But the next level of sophistication is to use the balun as we just discussed. Over to you, Mel. I bet most of your dipoles have got balans. Either that or you've got open wire feed to them. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Well, yeah, I guess you brought some very good points. I do recommend the balun. It basically started really to come into more of its significance with the coming of solid-state transceivers, of course, and Class B amplifiers. Which, of course, is our classic unbalanced output that these piece of equipment have. So, with that situation, putting a balance into the system also discourages a type of condition that we used to refer to as the inverted L mode, L like in Lewis, inverted L mode, but I guess we don't have to get into that. So a one-to-one balance usually does the trick, even though I know it's seen in literature quite a number of times that the peak of a dipole possibly could be 300 ohms at a certain distance above ground level, and that what happens is if you change that the height above ground level, that the impedance may go down gradually and may go to 200 ohms. So you say, how do you come up with a one-to-one balance in that situation? I think that's where a lot of the confusion comes in, Dick, over.
An ordinary center-fed dipole where there's really a egg insulator in the center, let's say, for instance, you're building it on 75 meters, the 3.8 megacycle frequency band, and the total tip-to-tip distance is something like 132 feet long. So I guess you've got the 66 feet of wire to the right and 66 feet of wire to the left. That kind of a center-fed dipole at a reasonable altitude, 30 feet up or more, is very close to 70 ohms of impedance. As you change the height of the antenna above and below ground, you're going to get some deviation of reactive component and resistive component. I'm reasonably sure, Mel, there is no altitude at which a simple half-wave horizontally polarized dipole comes anywhere near 300 ohms of total impedance. If it's a folded dipole, yes, it starts off at 300 ohms impedance approximately. But an ordinary center-fed half-wave dipole, nowhere near 300 ohms, in my opinion. I will admit that you get real close to ground, you get a whole lot of reactants, the resistive component gets disturbed, the reactive component gets disturbed, you start getting a pretty big standing wave ratio. If I took that 80-meter dipole and tried operating at 5 feet above ground, it'll work, but I'll have to do quite a bit of action of retuning on my antenna tuner to make the transmitter happy. 5 feet above ground on 80 meters or 75 meters is, a very small fraction of 1 meter of one wavelength above ground. A dipole would like to be a half wavelength or so above ground to give you full performance. The higher the altitude, the better. Yes, you could operate 5 feet above ground with
repeater, timeout, cancel.
You could operate a horizontal dipole or Yagi antenna 5 feet above ground if you're on a much higher frequency, like 2 meters or 432, where the wavelength is much, much shorter. But on 80 meters, you don't want to operate a dipole that low. Now, in the case of the so-called Herbie Snake antenna, I can't remember Herbie's call letters. He was a famous guy, a LIMOC member, way back in 1985 or so, where he had an extremely restrictive zoning board in his particular town and a very restrictive landlord that allowed no external antennas on his property. So he made an arrangement of coaxial cables and wires and whatever fed in a fancy way that laid flat on his lawn, 0 feet above ground. And Herbie, with the Herbie Snake antenna, he called it his snake antenna, he did quite a bit of radiating on 14 megacycles with that antenna. And we heard him very well. I'll admit that a guy running the same number of watts in the same town with a real antenna up in the air was two or three S units stronger than Herbie. But Herbie got out and Herbie made contacts. So he had a 20-meter dipole-like antenna, flat against the ground, zero altitude, And on a dry day, it worked very well. On a wet day, not as well. So that in itself is an interesting experiment. It's not a showstopper. It's not the ideal way to go. I would have loved to know what kind of impedance he was getting out of that antenna. He didn't have the instrumentation to make the measurement. I wasn't smart enough to ask that question way back in 1985 when that scene took place. So if you're buying a balloon at all, the majority of the time, 1-to-1 is the one you want to buy. Yes, to buy a 4-to-1 or a 6-to-1 if you're building a half-wave folded dipole, if you think folded dipole is a better way to go. It's not that much better. Folded dipole gives you a little bit more bandwidth. There are other techniques of getting more bandwidth. K2KEY.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
K2RIW, you got it, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, Jerry Civic. Go back to Mr. Jerry Civic. I've read quite much about almost everything, I'm sure, that he's ever put in print that I could get a hold of. And his practical measurements have showed that he says the average dipole that he had tried, as you mentioned, plastic dipoles, he says most of them, he says, showed impedances around 100 ohms. For practicality of his way, he was able to test it at up to, say, half wavelength above ground. And so he was recommending that most of the dipoles seem to work for his measurements with a 2-to-1 balun that he was publishing. And he did mention that many cases, because of topography and all, that he's seen resistances of 200 ohms and all. And so that's why he did outline a number of situations, of course, like I say, being a purist, where he's gone to such things as 4-to-1 balance, even. I mean, like, of course, Jerry Civic even went to as far as putting up antennas with open wire feeders and bringing it in, and actually did go as far as building balance up to 16-to-1. But I don't know. I have a feeling that the one that they sell, the 2-to-1 balance, may be the ideal for the situation. I no doubt that the 1-to-1 is going to make a lot of difference, but I would say possibility that being that 2-to-1 balance seems to be a very popular item also, Dick, that possibly you can't go wrong with it, over.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Yeah, there's a problem here, though, Mel. When Jerry is talking about 100 ohm impedance for his particular dipole, he's probably talking about the total impedance of the resistive component combined with the reactive component, and he took the sum of the square root of the square. He squared the resistive component, squared the reactive component, summed them together, and took the square root to measure total impedance. And that is the formula often used for measuring total impedance. So total impedance of 100 ohms. That doesn't mean that the resistive component is 100 ohms. You're setting the balun impedance not because of the resistance plus reactance. The main function of the balun is to equal the resistive component. If your antenna has a reactive component left over, and if you're a smart enough guy, you hang the right kind of capacitor or inductor at the center of the dipole to get rid of the reactive component. Or you put some other structure on the dipole, top hat capacitors at the end, or a loading coil, or whatever. There's a zillion ways of doing it. But to remove the reactive component of an antenna is so simple. To not do it is a little bit foolish. So I'm reasonably convinced that Jerry did not measure 100 ohms of resistive component. And here's what I'm going by. Let me drop. If you really want to measure, if you really want to know measured performance done under laboratory conditions for every possible dipole, you open up Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and that can be edition number 2, 3, or 4. Essentially, all the editions of the McGraw-Hill Antenna Engineering Handbook, Chapter 4. The one exception is the very first edition, 19... was it 1962? I've forgotten the year. I think it was 1962, the very first edition. There it was contained in Chapter 3. But the very first set of curves on either chapter